and it will be on the runway, provided we supply a forklift, that they return what they stole from me.
Ga was suddenly offended. They won't taste our corn biscuits or fire our pistols? The deer leader's laugh lines went slack, and he regarded Ga with eyes so serious that a stranger would take them for sad.
In doing this, they steal from me something much larger.
What about the Texas ranch? He asked the deer leader. We've built it complete.
Dismantle it. Move it to the airport, he said. Put it in a hangar where we can access it if we decide we can still use some of it.
Everything? The snakes? The river eels?
You have eels? Now I'm really sorry I missed it.
Ga tried to visualize taking a hearth apart, or a branding pit. That monstrous branding iron now seemed like a labor of love, and he couldn't imagine it packed away in the cinema house's property lot, as likely to see the light of day again as a hand-painted silken flag of Texas. Do the Americans offer a reason? The deer leader's eyes panned the room, trying, Ga could tell, to find a gift that might match his humiliation.
The Americans say there is a window 2 days from now in which no Japanese spy satellites will be flying over. The Americans fear the Japanese would be furious to learn that... Oh, fuck them,
the deer leader said.
Do they not know that on my soil they play by my rules? Do they not know that when their wheels touch the ground, they are beholden to me, to my tremendous sense of duty?
I know the gift, Commander Ga said. The deer leader eyed him with suspicion. When our delegation left Texas, there were a couple of surprises at the airport. The deer leader said nothing. There were two pallets, the kind of forklift would use. The first was loaded with food.
A pallet of food? This was not in the report I read. No one confessed to that.
The food was not from the senator, but from his church. There were barrels of flour and 100-kilo sacks of rice, burlap bags of beans, all stacked up in a cube and wrapped tight with plastic.
Food?
The deer leader asked. Ga nodded.
Go on,
the deer leader said. And on another skid were little Bibles, thousands of them, shrink-wrapped in plastic.
Bibles,
the deer leader said. Very small ones, with green vinyl covers.
How have I not heard any of this?
Of course we didn't accept it. We left it on the runway.
On the runway?
The deer leader said. There was one other thing, Commander Ga said. A dog, a baby one. It was given to us by the senator's wife herself, bred from her own stock.
Food aid,
the deer leader said, his eyes darting about, thinking.
Bibles? And a dog.
The food is already prepared, Ga said.
And of the Bibles?
Ga smiled. I know an author whose thoughts on opera should be required reading in all civilized nations. 1,000 copies could easily be obtained. The deer leader nodded.
About the dog, what Korean pet would be the equivalent? A tiger, perhaps? A tremendous snake?
Why not give them a dog back? We'll say it's the senator's dog, and say we're returning it because it's selfish, lazy, and materialistic.
This dog,
the deer leader said,
must be the most vicious, snarling cur in all the land. It must have tasted the blood of baboons in the central zoo, and chewed on the bones of half-starved prisoners in Camp 22.
The deer leader looked off, as if he wasn't at the bottom of a bunker, but on a plane, watching the senator being ravaged by a rabid canine for the 16 hours it took to return to Texas. I know just the dog, Commander Ga said.
You know?
The deer leader said.
You broke my driver's nose.
Ga said. The nose will heal back stronger.
Spoken like a true North Korean,
the deer leader said.
Come, Commander. There's something I've been meaning to show you.
They moved to another floor, to another room that looked just like the last one. Ga understood that sameness was meant to confuse an invading force, but wasn't the effect worse on those who must daily endure it? In the halls, he could feel the presence of security teams, always just out of sight, making the dear leader seem eternally alone. In the room was a school desk with a lone computer monitor, its green cursor blinking.
"Here's the machine I promised to show you,"
the dear leader said.
"Were you secretly mad at me for making you wait?"
"Is this the master computer?" Ga asked.
"It is,"
the dear leader answered.
"We used to have a dummy version, but that was only for interrogations. This one contains the vital information for every single citizen. It tells you date of birth or date of death, current location, family members, and so on. When you type in a citizen's name, all this information is sent to a special agency that dispatches a crow right away."
The dear leader ushered Commander Ga into the chair. Before him was only the black of the screen, that green flash. "Everyone's in here?" Ga asked.
"Every man, woman, and child,"
the dear leader said.
"When a name is typed on this screen, it is sent to our finest team. They act with great dispatch. The person in question will be found and transported right away. There is no evading its reach."
The dear leader pushed a button, and on the screen appeared a number. 22,604,301. He pressed the button again, and the number changed. 22,604,302.
"Witness the miracle of life," the dear leader said. "Do you know we are 54% female? We didn't discover that until this machine. They say that famine favors the girls. In the South, it's the opposite. They have a machine that can tell if a baby will be a boy or a girl. And the girls, they dispose of. Can you imagine that? Killing a girl baby, still in the mother?"
Ga said nothing. All babies in Prison 33 were killed. Every couple of months, there was a termination day in which rows of pregnant inmates had their bellies injected with saline. The guards had a wooden box on casters that they pushed around with their feet. Into this went, one by one, purple and dog paddling, the partly developed babies as they came.
"But we will have the last word,"
the dear leader said.
"A version is being created with every South Korean's name inside, so that there will be no one beyond our reach. That's real reunification, don't you think? Being able to place a guiding hand on the shoulder of every Korean, North or South? With good infiltration teams, it will be like the DMZ doesn't exist. In the spirit of one Korea, I offer you a gift. Type in the name of a person you'd like found, for whom resolution is lacking, and they will be dealt with. Go ahead, any name. Perhaps someone who wronged you during the arduous march, or a rival from the orphanage."
The parade of people came to Ga, all those whose absences hung like empty dry docks in his memory. Throughout his life, he'd felt the presence of people he'd lost, eternally just out of reach. And here he was, seated before the collected fates of everyone. Yet he did not know his parents' names, and the only information an orphan's name gives is that he's an orphan. Since Sun Moon had come into his life, he stopped wondering what had happened to Officer Sa, and the second mate and his wife. The captain's name is the one he would have typed, but there was no need for that now. And Mongnan and Dr. Song, those were the last names he'd enter, as he wanted them to live forever in his memory. In the end, there was only one person who was haunting him, whose fate and location he had to know about. Commander Ga put his fingers to the keys and typed, "Commander Ga Cholchon." When the dear leader saw this, he was beside himself.
Oh, that's rich,
he said.
Oh, that's a new one. You know what this machine does, right? You know what kind of team waits for these names? It's good, too good, but I can't let you do it.
The dear leader hit the delete button and shook his head.
He typed his own name. Wait till I tell everyone at dinner tonight. Wait till they hear the story of how the commander entered his own name into the master computer.
The green blinked at Ga like a faraway pulse in the dark. The dear leader clapped him on the shoulder.
Come,
he said.
One last thing. I need you to translate something for me.
When they reached the girl rower's cell, the dear leader paused outside. He leaned against the wall, tapping the key against the cement.
I don't want to let her go,
he said. Of course, a deal had been struck. The Americans would be here in a few days, and breaking a deal like this would never be forgiven. But God didn't mention any of that. He said, I understand exactly how you feel.
She has no idea what I'm talking about when I speak to her,
the dear leader said.
But that's okay. She has a curious mind, I can tell. I've been visiting her for a year. I've always needed someone like that, someone I can say things to. I like to think she enjoys my visits. Over time, I think I have grown on her. How she makes you work for a smile, but when she gives you one, it's real. You know it.
The dear leader's eyes were small and searching, as if he was trying not to see the fact that he would have to give her up. It was the way your eyes could scan the sloshing water in the bottom of a skiff, because to look anywhere else, at the beach, or the duct tape in your hands, or Officer Saw's stony face, was to acknowledge you were trapped, that very soon you'd be forced to do the thing you abhorred the most.
I have read that there is a syndrome,
the dear leader said.
In this syndrome, a female captive begins to sympathize with her captor. Often it leads to love. Have you heard of this?
The idea seemed impossible, preposterous to him. What person could shift allegiance toward their oppressor? Who could possibly sympathize with the villain who stole your life? Ga shook his head.
The syndrome is real, I assure you. The only problem is they say it sometimes takes years to work, which it seems we don't have.
He looked at the wall.
When you said you understood how I felt, did you mean that?
I did, he said. I do. The dear leader studied closely the ridges of the key in his hand.
I suppose you do,
he said.
You have Sun Moon. I used to confide in her. Yes, I used to tell her everything. That was years ago, before you came and took her.
He looked at Ga now, shaking his head.
I can't believe you're still alive. I can't believe I didn't throw you to the Pubyok. Tell me, where am I going to find another girl rower? One who's tall and beautiful, and who listens. A girl whose heart is true, and yet she still knows how to take the blood out of her friend with her bare hands.
He stuck the key in the lock.
So she doesn't understand the words I say to her. She gets the meaning, I'm sure of it. And she doesn't need words. Everything she feels crosses her face. Sun Moon was that way. Sun Moon was exactly like that,
he said, and turned the key in the lock. Inside, the girl rower was at her studies. Her notebooks were stacked high, and she was silently transcribing an English version of The Vigorous Zeal of the Revolutionary Spirit by Kim Jong-il. The dear leader stood, leaning against the open doorframe, admiring her at a distance.
She's read every word I've written, he said. That's the truest way to know the heart of another. Can you imagine it, Ga? If that syndrome is real, an American in love with me? Wouldn't that be the ultimate victory? A brawny, beautiful American girl. Wouldn't that be the last word?
Gah knelt next to her and slid the lamp across the table so he could get a better look. Her skin was so pale it seemed translucent. There was a rattle when she breathed from the damp air. The deer leader said,
"Ask her if she knows what a Chozonot is. I honestly doubt it. She hasn't seen another woman in a year. I bet the last woman she saw was being killed by her own hands."
Gah got her to lock eyes with him. "Do you want to go home?" he asked her. She nodded.
"Excellent," the deer leader said. "So she does know what a Chozonot is. Tell her I'll have someone come fit her for one."
"This is very important," Gah said to her. "The Americans are going to try to come get you. Right now, in your notebook, I need you to write what I say. Wanda, accept..."
"Tell her she will get her first bath, too,"
the deer leader interrupted.
"And assure her it will be a woman that helps her,"
Gah went on. "Write exactly what I say. Wanda, accept food aid, dog, and books." While she wrote, he looked back at the deer leader, backlit by the corridor lights. The deer leader said to him,
"Maybe I should let her out. Take her to that spa treatment at the Koryo Hotel. She might start to look forward to things like that."
"Excellent idea," Gah told him, then turned to the girl. Quietly, clearly, he said, "Add, hidden guests bring a valuable laptop."
"Maybe I should spoil her a little,"
the deer leader mused, looking at the ceiling.
"Ask her if there's anything she wants. Anything."
"When we leave, destroy that paper," Gah told her. "Trust me, I'm going to get you home. In the meantime, is there anything you need?"
"Soap,"
she said. "Soap," he told the deer leader.
"Soap?"
the deer leader asked.
"Didn't you just tell her that she was getting a bath?"
"Not soap," Gah told her.
"Not soap?"
she asked.
"Toothpaste, then. And a brush."
She meant the kind of soap you clean your teeth with, Gah told him. "You know, toothpaste and a brush." The deer leader stared first at her, then at him. He pointed the cell key at Gah.
"She grows on a person, doesn't she?"
the deer leader asked.
"How can I give her up? Tell me, what do you think the Americans would do if they came here? Returned my property, got humiliated, and left with nothing but bags of rice and a mean dog?"
"I thought that was the plan."
"Yes, that was the plan. But all my advisors, they're like mice in a munitions factory. They tell me not to anger the Americans, that I can only push them so far, that now that the Americans know the girl rowers alive, they'll never relent."
"The girl is yours," Gah said. "That is the only fact. People must understand that whether she stays or goes, or becomes a cinder in Division 42, it is as you wish it. If the Americans receive a tutorial in this fact, it doesn't matter what happens to her."
"True, true,"
the deer leader said.
"Except I don't want to let her go. Is there a way, you think?"
"If the girl met with the senator and told him herself that she wished to stay, then maybe there would be no incident." The deer leader shook his head at that distasteful suggestion.
"If only I had another girl roar," he said. "If only our little killer here hadn't done away with her friend. Then I could have sent home the one I liked the least."
Here he laughed.
"That's all I need, right? Two bad girls on my hands."
He wagged his finger at her.
"Bad girl, bad girl,"
he said, laughing.
"Very bad girl."
Commander Gah produced his camera. "If she's going to get cleaned up and fitted for a Chozonot," he said, "I'll need to get a before photo." He neared her and squatted low to snap the picture. "And maybe an action shot," he announced, "of how our guest has documented the amassed knowledge of our glorious leader, Kim Jong-il." He nodded to her. Now hold up the book. Commander Gaw was squinting to make sure everything fit perfectly. The woman and her book, the note to Wanda. Everything had to be in focus. When he saw through the viewfinder that the dear leader was crouching down and squeezing into the frame, his hand pulling her close by her shoulder. Gaw stared at the strange and dangerous image before him and decided it was right that cameras were illegal.
Tell her to smile,
the dear leader said. Can you smile? He asked. She smiled. The truth is, Gaw said, his finger on the button, that eventually everyone goes away. That these words should come from the lips of Commander Gaw made the dear leader grin.
Isn't that the truth of it?
He responded. In English, Gaw said, say cheese. And then the dear leader and his dear rower were blinking together from the flash.
I want copies of those,
the dear leader said, straining to get back to his feet.
I stayed late at Division 42. My body felt weak. It was like there was some nourishment I was missing, like my body was hungering for some kind of food I had simply never run across. I thought of the dogs in the Central Zoo that lived only on cabbage and old tomatoes. Had they forgotten the taste of meat? I felt like there was something, some sustenance, that I'd simply never known. I breathed deeply, but the air smelled no different. Grilled onion stalks, boiling peanuts, millet in the pan, dinner in Pyongyang. There was nothing to do but go home. Much of the city's electricity was being diverted to run industrial rice dryers south of town, so the subway was shut down, and the line for the Gwangbok Express bus was 3 blocks long. I started walking. I didn't make it 2 blocks before I heard the bullhorns and knew I was in trouble. The Minister of Mass Mobilization and his cadres were moving through the district, sweeping up any citizen unlucky enough to be out on the street. Just the sight of their yellow insignia sickened me. You couldn't run. If they even thought you were trying to avoid volunteering for harvest duty, it was off to a redeemability farm for a month of labor and group criticism. It was, however, the kind of thing a pubic badge could get you out of. Without it, I found myself in the back of a dump truck headed to the countryside to harvest rice for 16 hours. We drove northeast by moonlight toward the silhouetted Mohyang Range, a dump truck filled with city folks in professional attire, the driver flashing on his headlamps when he thought he saw something in the road. But there was nothing in the road. No people, no cars, nothing but empty highways lined with tank traps and large Chinese excavators. Their orange arms frozen in extension, abandoned by the canals for want of parts. In the dark, we found a peasant village somewhere along the Chongchon River. We city folk, about 100 of us, climbed down to sleep on the open ground. I had a smock to keep me warm and my briefcase for a pillow. The stars above seemed placed for my pleasure, and it was a welcome change from sleeping under dirt and goats. For 5 years, I'd used a badge to escape harvest details, so I had forgotten the sounds of crickets and frogs in the summer, the pungent mist that rises off the rice water. I heard children somewhere playing a game in the dark, and I heard the sounds of a man and a woman engaged in what must have been intercourse. What followed was my best night of sleep in years. There was no breakfast, and my hands blistered before the sun was fully up. For hours, I did nothing but dig open irrigation dams and backfill running canals. Why we drained one field and flooded another, I had no idea. But light dawned hard on the peasants of Chang'an province. They all wore cheap, ill-fitting vinylon clothes, They had nothing but black sandals, and their bodies were rail thin with cracked dark skin and teeth translucent to their black cores. Every woman with a hint of beauty had been siphoned to the capital. It turned out I showed too little promise as a rice harvester and was instead sent to empty latrine pots, raking the contents in between layers of rice hull. Then I dug ruts through the village that I was told would be of use when the rains came. An old woman, too old to work, watched me dig. She smoked her own kind of cigarette, rolled in corn husks, and told me many stories. But because she lacked teeth, I could not understand them. In the afternoon, a city woman was struck by a grand snake, long as a man. They gave her wound a poultice. I tried to quiet her screams by stroking her hair, but that snake bite must have done something to her. She started hitting me and pushing me away. The peasants by then had caught the twisting snake, black as the befecal water that had concealed it. Some wanted to take its gallbladder, others wished to milk its venom for liquor. They appealed to the old woman, who motioned for them to free it. I watched the snake swim away through a paddy field cleared of rice. The shallow water was both dark and flashing with sunset. The snake took its own course, away from all of us, and I had a feeling there is another black snake out across the water, waiting for this broad swimmer to make its way home to her. It was midnight when I made it home. Though the key turned in the lock, the door wouldn't open. It was somehow barricaded from within. I pounded on the door. "Mother," I called. "Father, it's me, your son. There's something wrong with the door. You must open it for me." I pleaded for a while, then put my shoulder to the wood, leaning into it some, but not too hard. Breaking down a door would cause much discussion in the building. Finally, I buttoned my smock and lay down in the hall. I tried to think of the sounds of the crickets and the children running in the dark. But when I closed my eyes, I could imagine only cold cement. I thought of the peasants with their ropey bodies and harsh manner of speaking, of how, except for starvation, they didn't have a care in the world. In the dark, I heard a sound. Bing! It was the red cell phone. I found the phone, its green light flashing. On the tiny screen was a new picture. A Korean boy and a Korean girl stood half stunned, half smiling against the sunny blue sky. They wore black caps with ears that made them look like mice. Come morning, the door was standing open. Inside, my mother was cooking porridge while my father sat at the table.
"Who's there?"
my father asked.
"Is someone there?"
I could see that one of the chairs had a shiny spot on its back where the doorknob had rubbed.
"It's me, father, your son." "Thank goodness you're back," my father said. "We were worried about you."
My mother said nothing. On the table were the files I had pulled on my parents. I'd been studying them all week. They looked like they'd been rifled.
"I tried to get in last night, but the door was blocked," I said.
"Didn't you hear me?"
"I didn't hear anything,"
father said. He spoke to the air.
"My wife, did you hear anything?"
"No," she said from the stove. "I heard nothing, nothing at all." I straightened the files.
"I suppose you two have gone deaf now as well."
My mother shuffled to the table with two bowls of porridge, her feet sliding in baby steps, lest she stumble in her darkness. I asked, "But why was the door blocked? You aren't afraid of me, are you?"
"Afraid of you?" my mother asked.
"Why would we be afraid of you?" asked my father.
My mother said,
"The loudspeaker said
the American Navy was conducting aggressive military exercises off the coast.
You can't take any chances, my father said. With the Americans, you must take measures.
They blew on their food and took quiet spoonfuls. How is it, I asked my mother, that you cook so well without your sight?
I can feel the heat that comes off the pan, she said. And as the food cooks, the smell changes.
What about the knife?
Using the knife is easy, she said. I guide it with my knuckles. Stirring food in the pan is the hardest. I always spill.
In my mother's file was a photo of her when she was young. She was a beauty, perhaps the reason she was brought to the capital from the countryside. But what got her sentenced to a factory rather than assigned as a singer or a hostess was not in her record. I ruffled the folders so they could be heard.
There were some papers on the table, my father said, his voice nervous.
They fell to the floor, my mother said, but we picked them up.
It was an accident, my father added.
Accidents happen, I told him.
Those papers, my mother said. Were they work-related?
Yes, father said. Were they part of a case you're working on?
Just research, I said.
They must be important files if you brought them home,
my father said.
Is anyone in trouble? Perhaps someone we know?
What's going on here? I asked. Is it about Mrs. Kwok? Are you still mad at me for that?
I didn't want to turn her in.
She was the one stealing coal from the furnace. In winter, we were all colder because of her selfishness.
Don't get mad, my mother said. We were just showing concern for the unlucky souls in your files.
Unlucky? I asked. What makes you call them unlucky? They both went silent. I turned toward the kitchen and looked at the can of peaches perched above the top cabinet. I had a feeling the can had been moved a little, inspected perhaps by this blind duo, but I couldn't be sure of the direction I left the can facing. Slowly, I waved my mother's file once before her eyes, yet she made no track of it. Then I fanned her with the file, so the breeze moved across her face, surprising her. My mother recoiled, inhaling with fright.
What is it?
My father asked her.
What happened?
She said nothing. Can you see me, mother? I asked. It's important that I know if you can see me. She faced my direction, though her eyes were focusless.
Can I see you?
She asked me.
I see you as I first saw you, in glimpses through darkness.
Spare me the riddles, I warned her. I have to know.
You were born at night, she said. I labored all day, and when darkness fell, we had no candles. You came by feel into your father's hands.
My father lifted his hands, scarred by mechanical looms.
These hands, he said.
Such was the year Juche 62, my mother said. Such was life in a factory dormitory. Your father lit match after match.
One after another, until they were gone,
my father said.
I touched every part of your body, at first to see if you were whole, and then to know you. So new you were, so innocent. You could have become anyone. It took a while until first light that we got a look at what we had created.
Were there other children? I asked. Was there another family? My mother ignored this.
Our eyes do not work. That is the answer to your question. But then as now, we do not need sight to see what you have become.
On Sunday, Commander Ga strolled with Sun Moon along the Chosun relaxation footpath, which followed the river to the central bus terminal. In this public place, they thought they might not be overheard. Old people filled the benches, and because a new book had been published that month, young people lay in the grass reading copies of the novel, All for Her Country. Commander Ga could smell the hot ink from the presses of the Rodong Shinmun, which, rumor had it, printed on Sunday afternoons all the newspaper editions for the week to come. Whenever Ga spotted a hungry-eyed urchin crouched in the bushes, he'd toss him a couple of coins. Sun Moon's children seemed oblivious to these orphans hiding in their midst. The boy and the girl ate flavored ice and wandered through willows, whose late summer arms hung low enough to sweep the gravel path. Commander Ga and Sun Moon had been speaking in abstractions and half-notions, dancing around the facts of the very real thing they had set in motion. He wanted to put a name to what they were doing, to call it escape, defection. He wanted to outline the steps, to memorize them, and practice out loud how they would go. "Like a script," he said. He asked her to say she understood that the worst could happen. She would speak of none of this. Instead, she remarked on the crunch of the gravel under her feet, of the groan of the river dredges as they bent their rusty booms below the surface. She stopped to smell an azalea, as if it were the last azalea. And as she walked, she wove fine purple bracelets from wisteria. She wore a white cotton chosanot that outlined her body with shifts in the breeze. "I want to tell the children before we leave," he said. This, perhaps because it seemed so preposterous to her, moved her to speak.
"Tell them what?" she asked. "That you killed their father? No, they're going to grow up in America, believing that their dad was a great hero, whose remains rest in a faraway land."
"But they have to know," he said, then was silent a moment as a brigade of soldiers' mothers passed by, shaking their red cans to intimidate Songun donations from people. "Those kids have to hear it from me," he went on. "The truth, an explanation. These are the most important things for them to hear. This is all I have to give them."
"But there will be time," she said. "This decision can be made later, when we're safe in America."
"No," he told her. "It must be now." Commander Ga looked back at the boy and the girl. They were watching this conversation, even though they were too far away to make out the words.
"Is something wrong?"
Sun Moon asked.
"Does the dear leader suspect something?"
He shook his head. "I don't think so," he said, though the question conjured the girl who rode in the dark, and the notion that the dear leader might not relinquish her. Sun Moon stopped by a cement water barrel and lifted its wooden cover. She drew a ladle and drank, her hands cupping the silver dipper. Commander Ga watched a trickle of water darken the front of her chosanot. He tried to imagine her with another man. If the dear leader didn't let go of his girl rower, then the plan was off. The Americans would leave in outrage, and something bad would soon happen to Commander Ga. As for Sun Moon, she would become a prize once more to whatever replacement husband was found. And what if the dear leader was right? What if over the years she came to love this new husband, real love, not the promise of love or the potential for love? Could Commander Ga leave this world, knowing her heart was destined for another? Sun Moon plunged the ladle deep into the barrel to get the cool water at the bottom before holding the dipper for Ga to drink. The water tasted mineral and fresh. He wiped his mouth. "Tell me," he said to her. "Do you think it's possible for a woman to fall in love with her captor?" She observed him a moment. He could tell she was looking for signs as to how to answer. He said, "It's impossible, right? The idea is completely insane, don't you think?" He saw in his mind a parade of all the people he'd captured, their wide eyes and abraded faces, the white of their lips when the duct tape was torn off. He saw those red toenails rearing to strike. "I mean, all they can have is contempt for you, for taking everything from them. Tell the truth. Say there can be no such syndrome."
"Syndrome?" she asked.
He looked over at the children, frozen in mid-stride. They often played a game to see which one could be the most statue-like. The dear leader has read of a syndrome, and he believes that if he keeps a certain woman imprisoned long enough, she will come to love him.
A certain woman?
Sun Moon asked. It's not important who she is, he said. All that matters is that she's American. A delegation is coming for her, and if the dear leader doesn't hand her over, our plan is ruined.
You said she was a captive. What? Is she in a cage or a prison? How long has this been going on?
She's in his private bunker. She was going around the world but had a problem on her boat. They plucked her out of the sea, and now the dear leader's infatuated with her. He goes down there at night and plays her operas composed in his honor. He wants to keep her down deep until she develops feelings for him. Have you ever heard of anything like this? Tell me there's no such thing. Sun Moon was quiet a moment. Then she said, What if a woman had to sleep in the same bed as her captor? Ga eyed her to see what she was getting at. Sun Moon said,
What if she depended on her captor for every necessity? Food, cigarettes, clothes. And he could indulge or deprive her at his whim.
She looked at him as though she truly wanted an answer, but he could only wonder if she was speaking of himself or his predecessor.
What if a woman had children with her captor?
Ga took the ladle from her hands and drew water for the boy and the girl, but they were now assuming the poses of the hammer and sickle bearers on the frieze of the Party Foundation monument, and even the heat of the day could not make them break from their personas. That man is gone, he said. I'm here now. I'm not your captor. I'm liberating you. It's easy to talk about prisoners, but I'm the one trying to get you to say the word escape. That's what the dear leader's captive wants. She might be locked in a cell, but her heart is restless. She will leap at the chance to get out, trust me.
You sound like you know her,
Sun Moon said. There was a time, he told her. It seems like another life. I had a job transcribing radio transmissions on the sea. I listened from sunset to sunrise, and in the darkest hour I'd hear her, the girl rower. She and her friend were rowing around the world, but this one, she was the one that rowed all night, without the horizon to steer toward, or the sun to mark her progress. She was forever bound to the other rower, yet completely alone. She labored forward solely on duty, her body bowing to the oars, but her mind, the broadcast she made, never had a woman sounded so free. Sun Moon cocked her head and tried on those words.
Forever bound to another, she whispered. Yet, totally alone.
She added in self-reflection.
Is that how you want to live?
He asked. She shook her head.
Are you ready to talk about the plan?
She nodded.
Okay,
he said.
Just remember, forever bound yet alone. That could be a good thing. If for some reason we ended up separated, if somehow we didn't get out together, we could be bound, even if we weren't together. What are you talking about? She asked. There will be no alone. That's not how it's going to go.
What if something goes wrong? What if in getting the three of you out, I am left behind?
Oh no, she said. There is going to be none of that. I need you. I don't speak English. I don't know where to go. I don't know which Americans are informants and which are not. We're not going around the world with just the clothes on our backs.
Believe me, if something went wrong, I'd eventually join you. Somehow I'd make it, and you wouldn't be alone. The senator's wife would help you until I made my way to you.
I don't need someone's wife, she told him. I need you. It's you I must have. You don't understand what my life has been like, how I've been baited and tricked before.
You must believe me that I'll follow, Ga said. After you get safely out, I'll be right behind you. I've been to South Korea 12 times in my life, Japan 9 times, Russia twice, and I have seen the sun rise and set on Texas soil. I will join you.
No, 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 she said. You never do that to me. You never disappear on me. We all go together. Your job is to make that happen. Is it the Casablanca movie that's got you confused?
Her voice was rising now.
You don't stay behind like a martyr, like Rick. Rick failed at his job. His job was to...
She stopped herself before she became too upset. Instead, she gave him that voluptuous actress smile of hers.
You can't leave me. I'm your captive, she said. What good's a captive without her captor? Won't we need a lot of time together if we're to prove once and for all if the dear leader syndrome is true?
He could hear the lie in her voice. Her acting, he could recognize it now. But he saw the desperation and vulnerability underneath, and he loved her all the more for it. Of course I'm going with you, Ga told her. I'll always be with you. And then came the kiss. It started with a tilt of her head, her eyes flashing to his mouth, a hand slowly reaching to his collarbone where it rested. And then she leaned in, the slowest lean in the world. He recognized the kiss. It was from Hold the Banner High, the one she planted on the weak-minded South Korean border guard, distracting him while her band of freedom fighters cut the power to the Century Tower and began the liberation of South Korea from the hands of its capitalist oppressors. He'd dreamed of that kiss, and now it was his. Into his ear, she whispered,
Let's escape.
Citizens, open your windows and cast your eyes upward, for a crow flies above Pyongyang, its raked beak twitching at every possible threat to the patriotic populace below. Hear the black wings beat, flinch at his sharp call. Observe this master of the air swooping into the schoolyards to sniff all the children for traces of cowardice, then dive, claws extended, to gauge the loyalty of the doves that adorn the statue of Kim Il-sung. Being the only animal with eyes sharp enough to spot virginity, witness our crow circle a Juche youth troop and nod in approval as this illustrious avian performs an aerial inspection of their reproductive purity. But America's what's really on this crow's mind. It's not hunting chestnut thieves or peering in housing block windows for the telltale paw prints of illegal dog farming. No, citizens. The Americans have accepted the dear leader's invitation to visit Pyongyang, the most glorious capital in the world. So the dark wings that protectively cast their shadow upon the fields of Arirang are hunting for any hint of capitalist sympathizers. One traitor is all it would take to disillusion a land so pure it knows nothing of materialist greed or war crime sneak attacks. Luckily, citizens, no animal keeps its benevolent eye on the Korean people like the crow. It won't let ours become a nation where people give names to canines, oppress others because of the color of their skin, and eat pharmaceutically sweetened pills to abort their babies. But why, you ask, does this crow circle the Chosun relaxation footpath? Isn't this where our finest citizens come to stroll? Where young people gather to wash the feet of the old, and where on a hot day, wet nurses volunteer their paps to refresh Pyongyang's finest Yongban babies? The keen-eyed crow is here, citizens, because it spotted a man tossing a shiny object into the bushes, where some scrambling orphans fought to obtain it. Not only does the giving of coins to orphans rob them of their self-respect and Juche spirit, it violates a central rule of good citizenship. Practice self-sufficiency. Looking more closely, the crow noted that as this man spoke to a woman, He made certain gestures that were clear indicators of the discussion of a plan. Tomorrow is a concern of the state, citizens. Tomorrow is the business of your leaders, and you must leave what's to come in their hands. So another rule of good citizenship had been violated. Refrain from the future. It was then that this crow recognized the violator as Commander Ga, a man who had recently been observed disregarding all the rules of good citizenship. Devote yourself eternally to our glorious leaders. Treasure criticism. Obey Sungon policies. Pledge yourself to collective child rearing and conduct regular martyrdom drills. It was here, spellbound by beauty, that the crow almost fell from the sky when it realized that the woman speaking to this loathsome citizen was none other than Sun Moon. Wings arresting a free fall, the bird dropped between our mismatched couple. There was a message in the crow's beak, and when Commander got bent to retrieve it, the bird leaped high, caw, and lashed its wings at Ga's face. The bird then turned to face Sun Moon. The note she saw was intended for her. When she unfolded the strip of paper, it bore only the name of our dear leader, Kim Jong-il. A black Mercedes suddenly appeared, and a man with a splint on his nose hurried to open the door for Sun Moon. She was on her way to visit the great general who had discovered her, who had written all her movies, who has spent many a long night counseling her on the proper ways of depicting our nation's triumphs over adversity. Great leader, diplomat, strategist, tactician, athlete, filmmaker, author, and poet. All this, and yes, Kim Jong-il was a friend too. Passing through the streets of Pyongyang, Sun Moon leaned her head against the car window and regarded, as if with sadness, the rays of sunlight glowing golden in the millet-dusted air of the Central Ration Depot. It looked as though she might weep passing the children's theater, where as a girl she had learned the accordion, the art of puppetry, and mass gymnastics. "Whatever became of my old teachers?" her eyes seemed to ask. And it was not without tears that she beheld the fanciful spires of the ice rink, one of the rare places her mother, ever mindful of American sneak attacks, would dare to venture. No one upon the ice in those days could do anything but cheer for young Sun Moon, her girl limbs flaring through the leaps, the joy on her face dazzling through a spray of her blade's ice crystals. Poor Sun Moon. It was almost as if she knew she would never see these sights again, as if she had some kind of premonition of what the savage, remorseless Americans had in store for her. What woman wouldn't weep all along Reunification Boulevard to think she would never again see a street so clean, a ration line so perfectly straight, or hear again the crimson banners fluttering 1,000 strong in a chain of red flags that extolled every word of Kim Il-sung's great speech of October 18, Juche 63. Sun Moon was brought before the dear leader in a room that had been designed to put the visiting Americans at ease. Its muted lamps, dark mirrors, and wooden tables were reminiscent of an American speakeasy, which is a type of establishment that Americans frequent in order to evade the eyes of their repressive government. Behind the heavy doors of a speakeasy, Americans are free to abuse alcohol, fornicate, and violence each other. Over his smart jumpsuit, the dear leader wore an apron. On his forehead, he sported a green visor, while a rag was draped over his shoulder. He came from behind the bar with his arms extended. "Sun Moon," he called, "what can I serve you?" Their embrace was filled with the zest of socialist comradeship. "I don't know," she said. He told her, "You're supposed to say the usual." "The usual," she said. Here he poured for them modest snifters of North Korean cognac, which is known for its medicinal properties. Looking more closely, the deer leader saw that there was sadness in her eyes. "What's got you down?" he asked her. "Tell me the story. I'll give it a happy ending." "It's nothing," she said. "I'm just practicing for my new movie role." "But this movie is a happy one," he reminded her. "Your character's undisciplined husband is replaced with a highly efficient one. Soon all the farmers have increased their yields. Something else must be bothering you. Is it a matter of the heart?" "I only have room in my heart for the Democratic People's Republic of Korea," she said. The deer leader smiled. "That's my son, Moon," he said. "That's the girl I miss. Come, look, I have a present for you." From behind the bar, the deer leader produced an American musical instrument. "What is it?" she asked. "It's called a guitar. It's used to perform American rural music. It's said to be especially popular in Texas," he told her. "It's also the instrument of choice for playing the blues, which is a form of American music that chronicles the pain caused by poor decision-making." Sun Moon ran her delicate fingers across the strings of the guitar. It produced a muted groan, as if a vibrant kayagum had been wrapped in a blanket and doused with a bucket of water. "The Americans have much to be sad about," she said, plucking another string. "But listen to it. I can make no song with this." "But you must. You must," said the deer leader. "Please make it perform for me." She strummed. "I regret that my heart," she sang, "is not as big as my love." "That's it," he said. She strummed. "For the most democratic nation," she went on, "the Democratic People's Republic of Korea." "That's good," he said. "Now less bird-like. Sing with the heat of your blood." On the bar, she placed the guitar flat on his back, the way a proper stringed instrument is played. She tried to finger the strings so that different notes might sound. "The Yankees are happy," she sang and strummed hard. "The Yankees are sad." The deer leader beat the rhythm on the bar top with his fist. "Our nation doesn't see the difference," she belted. "Satisfaction's all we've ever had." Together, they laughed. "I miss all this," he said. "Remember how we used to speak of movie scripts late into the night? How we professed our love of country and embraced reunification?" "Yes," she said, "but all that changed." "Did it?" "I used to wonder if," the deer leader said, "if something happened to your husband on one of his many dangerous missions, if we'd become friends again. Of course, your husband is alive and well, and your marriage is better than ever, I'm sure. But if something had happened to your husband, if he'd been lost in one of his many heroic missions for our nation, would I have been right to think that we would become close again? That we would again stay up into the night sharing notions of Juche and Songun scholarship?" She pulled her hand from the guitar. "Is something going to happen to my husband? Is that what you're trying to tell me? Is there a dangerous mission you must send him on?" "No, no, banish the thought," said the deer leader. "Nothing could be further from the truth. Of course I could never say for sure. It must be stated that the world is a dangerous place, and the future is known only to high-ranking officials." Sun Moon said, "Your fatherly wisdom always did have the power to soothe my female fears." "It is one of my gifts," replied the beneficent leader Kim Jong-il in all his glory. "I must make note," he continued, "that you do call him husband." "I don't know what else to call him." The deer leader nodded. "But you do not answer my question." Sun Moon crossed her arms and turned from the bar. She took two steps, then turned back. "I, too, yearn for our late-night conversations," she said. "But those days are past now." "But why?" the deer leader asked. "Why must they be past?" "Because I hear you have a new confidant now, a new young pupil."
"I see someone has been speaking to you, sharing certain things."
When a citizen is given a replacement husband, it is her duty to share certain things with him. Have you? The dear leader asked. Have you been sharing?